WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, Lech Wałęsa, the former head of Solidarity, became the first popularly elected president of Poland since the Second World War. But Poland's spirit of solidarity has been replaced by infighting between the leaders of the peaceful revolution. My guest Lawrence Weschler has been writing about Poland for The New Yorker since the birth of the Solidarity movement. His most recent trip to Poland was in October. He went to observe the presidential campaign and the political and social transitions from communism to democracy.
I was astonished at the virulence of the infighting. I mean, it really was... friendships, the movement, and so forth had broken apart, but in ways, people were, there were transferences all over the place. It had kind of the intensity of Last Tango in Warsaw almost. I mean, it was particularly, for example, and one doesn't want to personalize it too much, but the relationship between Lech Wałęsa, as you know, the electrician who became the leader of Solidarity, and Adam Michnik, who was this extraordinary, remarkable intellectual who was one of the leading theorists of Solidarity. They used to be very, very close friends. Wałęsa is the godfather of Michnik's three-year-old child. Michnik used to write when Wałęsa was invited to give homilies to the Virgin Mary on crucial moments, he would have his Jewish friend Michnik write them for him, and they would joke about this. And these very warm friends had broken apart spectacularly and, in fact, were just filled with recrimination and hatred and so forth of each other.
Didn't Wałęsa get the reputation during this election of just making promises that people wanted to hear, no matter how contradictory those promises were?
Well, that's, by the way, not that different from Wałęsa all along. I mean, people used to – Wałęsa, if you go back to my reporting in 1981, I mean, he is somebody who would get up, make a speech. He would make very contradictory – he would kind of articulate the mood of the crowd, which felt very contradictory things. By the way, this country is in a very contradictory situation. It's no wonder. So he would be saying things left and right. He'd be saying one thing and then the opposite, not in different speeches, in the same speech. His past reputation is that at a certain moment, he figures out what it is that needs to be done, what the crowd needs to do, wants done, about 30 seconds before the crowd figures it out, and he says it, and then they're all with him. This is very effective when you're in opposition. It's not at all clear that it can be effective when you're president. I mean, I remember back in 1981, people used to joke. They'd say, God, thank God for the communists. Otherwise, this guy would be our president. He's an extremely charismatic, contradictory character who has never, by the way, been in this position, the position he's now going to find himself in, and which may be very, very difficult. A friend of mine in Poland was saying, the thing you have to understand about Wałęsa is that there never would have been a Solidarity without Wałęsa, in the same way that there never would have been fascism without Mussolini, but also in the same way that there never would have been a Soviet human rights movement without Sakharov. Sakharov and Mussolini get married. They have a child, the baby, Wałęsa. And it's a kind of vivid way of describing the situation, but that kind of a-democratic quality in Wałęsa has always been there. It's only now that he's president, that for the first time he is going to be held accountable for the kinds of things he says.
Wałęsa just won a runoff election against Tominski, who was a Canadian entrepreneur, head of Canada's Libertarian Party. I mean, he hadn't lived in Poland
For starters, you make that sound like that's a party. It's an extreme fringe group.
A few people.
It's 3,000 people in all of Canada. And, this was, in a way... Wałęsa got stung by his own techniques. Tominski, if Wałęsa was a magic candidate making magic promises that were contradictory, Tominski didn't even bother with contradiction. He just made whole hog promises out of the sky. He was he claimed to be a multimillionaire. He exaggerated his wealth. He was in all sorts of strange ways. He was quite odd. At a news conference, a televised news conference, he suddenly said, I know there are people in this room trying to hypnotize me, but it won't work because I know all about hypnosis. He had made a fortune he had made some money in Peru with a cable television station for which the Peruvian government had investigated him for pirating signals and all sorts of odd behavior. I think Poles generally heard this and decided, far out, we'll have great cable television. it was a really Meshuggah election. And in a way, Wałęsa didn't know how to deal with this guy because, you know, Mazowiecki, the prime minister in the first round, had been saying we have to behave responsibly, and Wałęsa had been completely irresponsible in the kinds of promises he was making. Suddenly, after this guy Tominski beat out Mazowiecki, suddenly Wałęsa had to turn around and say, we have to behave responsibly. And this guy Tominski was making just incredible, strange promises that everybody in Poland would be be financially better off within 1 month of his becoming president, and that Poland should have an atomic bomb. I mean, all kinds of wild things.
My guest is journalist Lawrence Weschler, and he's been covering Eastern Europe for the past decade. He's made many trips to Poland and has written about it extensively for The New Yorker magazine. His latest article about Poland was in the December 10th issue of The New Yorker. Weschler was in Poland in October. There's a split in Solidarity now. What is the split about? I should ask you first, what is Solidarity now? Is it a political party? Is it a labor union?
It's dead. I mean, it's okay. How's that? I mean, there was this movement that, among other things, was a uniting of intelligentsia and workers. The notion was that the way to oppose communist rule was for the entire society to unite against repression and, in effect, develop an alternative society. And Solidarity did that spectacularly well. I think it's good in principle that in a democracy you don't have 10 million solid, as Solidarity used to describe itself. I mean, what you want in democracy is people expressing different interests and so forth. Unfortunately, in the current situation in Poland, things up till this point anyway have fractured in ways in which it's largely personality conflicts that become exacerbated by definite kind of feelings of disquiet and anxiety on the economic front, for example, but they don't yet get articulated in a way that you can make sensible choices between different economic alternatives. In the end, both Wałęsa and Mazowiecki were espousing basically the same system, a system which millions of Poles don't feel they have a stake in. Many of them voted for Tominski, but Tominski wasn't espousing any alternative. I guess if you're cynical, you can say that they've basically arrived in one short year at the kind of thing it took us 200 years to arrive at in the United States. I mean, the Democrats and the Republicans don't offer people real solid alternatives between different well-articulated economic viewpoints, for example.
When you say Solidarity is dead, do you mean literally or figuratively?
Well, I mean, there's the union. The union, which had in 1980-81 had 10 million members, never got much more than 2 million after it was re-legalized. The political party or the political movement of Solidarity, which was the movement that swept into power a year ago, has fractured disastrously and is over. But again, that's not the end of the world. That's the precondition for democracy. But by itself, it's not going to make democracy. And Poland is having a hard time developing a democratic system.
Solidarity had bridged intellectuals and workers. It had brought them together. Now that there's a democracy in place, is there still a connection between the intellectuals and the workers, or have they split up?
There were intellectuals who favored Wałęsa. There were workers who favored Mazowiecki in this last election. It's not a completely simple split. I think you could say that, generally speaking, the intelligentsia, which is to say people with linguistic aptitude, people with foreign contacts and so forth, are going to have an easier time as they go into a capitalist system. They are better equipped to deal effectively with the new environment. The people who are really being left by the wayside are the people at those factories, the dinosaur establishments, which tragically are the people who brought this whole thing about in the first place. I mean, you know, it's no different than any other country in the world, except for the fact that it's the very people who brought about the change, those people in the Gdansk shipyard, the people in the Nowohuta steelworks, the people in the mines and so forth, who were the ones who made this happen, who for the most part are being left behind.
They're being left behind because they're not in the class that's becoming the entrepreneurs and bringing in new goods
right.
to be marketed.
I mean, one way of thinking about it is that they're not the kind of people who can borrow $1,000 from a friend to start a small company.
Mm-hmm.
They're not the people who kind of people who can – if they want to start – one of the things that's supposed to happen is supposed to be all kinds of upsurge of service industries, laundries, travel agencies, whatever it is. But you need a little money to get started on that and beyond that. And many of these communities like Nova Huta, which are entirely devoted to one, you know, now decrepit and about to be closed factory, there's nobody who can afford to pay for laundry services or going traveling anywhere and so forth. So it's not working the way it should yet.
With the rise of a new entrepreneurial class in Poland, are you beginning to see a new class structure and more obvious differences between rich and poor?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the nomenklatura, the communist privileged classes in the earlier period were at least discreet about their privilege. I mean, they didn't flaunt it. The new people driving around in their Mercedes, you can make money extremely quickly if you have any money right now in Poland. And if you have kind of a talent. And the communists are I it should be said, by the way, that in many cases the people who do have money or do have contacts were former communists. I mean, that's one of the ironies, that the ones who are going to be the most effective capitalists were these people who had a head start because they were communists in the old system. And in any case, now you're beginning to see people just parading their luxuries of kind of nouveau riche and so forth. And this is just making people really crazy.
I'm sure one of the things that was very different about your trip to Poland this October as compared to previous trips is that there was an abundance of food in the stores and in the markets.
Right.
And there were no lines.
They had basically this shock plan, which was instituted January 1st of this year, stopped hyperinflation, and suddenly, basically from 1 week to the next, the stores were filled with food, with clothes, with all sorts of items. There was an abundance of stuff. The way they did this was that they basically, I'm being somewhat schematic here, but basically they froze wages and allowed prices to reach their own levels. And what you ended up with in this situation was kind of third world wages and first world prices. Prices for apples or potatoes or anything else suddenly, which had been subsidized, the subsidies were all slashed, and suddenly they cost more or less what they would cost in Germany or France. But meanwhile, Poles were earning $100, $150 a month.
So one of the reasons why there's no lines now is that people can't afford to buy the food that's in the stores.
And it's and psychologically, I think this is quite dramatic, because it used to be that Poles had a sense that they couldn't find anything in the stores, but whenever they saw something in the stores, they would buy it and they could afford to buy it. And now the situation is the exact opposite. They see all sorts of things. They see magnificent things. They see apples and pineapples and wool sweaters and fancy suits and so forth, and they can't afford to buy it, and there's no way they're going to be able to afford to buy it.
This leads to a different kind of resentment.
It leads to most immediately leads to an insane election.
Right. is there a new problem with unemployment in Poland?
It's beginning, and what they slashed the subsidies, or they're in the process of slashing the subsidies to those big factories. It used to be that those factories could lose money and the government would just pump in however much more money was needed to cover the difference. They are beginning to, and they haven't done it so very quickly yet, but they're going to start doing it much more quickly, to slash those subsidies and to let those companies go out of business. In theory, the people will get better work in services or whatever else happens to be around, but in the short term, certainly, there's no banking system, there's no infrastructure, there's no, you know, for example, you can't get a business started because there are no telephones and so forth, and there's no place for those people to find work in huge numbers in any case. So there is already beginning to be, and it's expected it will get much more dramatic in the immediate future, an increase in unemployment.
One of the big questions facing Poland and other countries in Eastern Europe is when you switch from a communist country to a democratic one, what happens to the factories and so on? What happens to everything that used to be state-owned? Does it become privately owned? And if so, who are the people who own it privately? And what happens to the workers? Yeah. What are some of the responses to that being considered now in Poland?
Well, it's an interesting problem. I mean, everybody here just says, oh, well, you just have to privatize and then everything will be fine. That's all very easy. But how do you do it specifically? For example, you can do what's called British-style auctions, where you just suddenly announce that you're going to offer this factory up for sale. But before you can do that, you have to evaluate it. You have to have accountants come in and let people know how much it's worth or what's in it and so forth. And even that's difficult. You have buildings that are owned by one ministry that have factories inside that are answerable to a second ministry, that use equipment that is answerable to a third ministry. Who owns what is not at all clear. It's terribly complicated. So some people are saying, well, maybe on second thought, we shouldn't try and sell the companies, but we can kind of give them away. And what we're basically trying to do is to create control rather than ownership. That's the thing. We want to have kind of a board of directors that will discipline the company. And so there are various schemes afoot for free distribution of money. If you think about the United States, I mean, here's an example about how things in Poland reflect in the United States. You know, the Ford family no longer owns Ford Motors. It's owned by shareholders and by and large by institutional shareholders. It's owned by insurance companies and pension plans and mutual funds and so forth. And one theory is you could let Poland slowly develop what took hundreds of years to develop here. Or another idea is just to start from scratch, to create ex nihilo pension funds and insurance companies and mutual funds and banks and so forth, and then just freely distribute the entire assets of the country in different percentages to these places in the hope that they will then elect boards of directors who will put some discipline on the economy. But even this has terrible complications, and it's not at all obvious how to do it. The most fascinating statistic to me is that has to do with the fact there isn't enough capital in Poland to buy Poland. The book value of the country, of the companies, of the different steel mills and so forth, is such that if you took all of the liquidity in Poland and tried to buy it, you'd only be able to buy 3.2% of the companies. And who would buy the rest? Germans and so forth. And Poles get terrified. I mean, did they go through all this to end up being, have Germans owning their companies and so forth, especially after the war? It's complicated and by no means obvious. And it's a bit disconcerting to see the blitheness with which American government officials and so forth tell the Poles or tell Gorbachev or tell anybody else, just go ahead and privatize your country.
Are people in Poland trained for capitalism? I mean, in the sense that people operated without the kinds of incentives that capitalism is based on and without the kind of authority that you have when you own something or when you're a manager.
Right. I mean, I think that there are, for one thing, it's a very educated workforce. They are extraordinarily competent. Technically, you have some spectacular computer programmers and computer designers, that sort of thing. You then have a lot of people who apparently are quite good managers. They may not have been allowed to manage before, but they probably would be pretty good managers. What you have beyond that, however, is the fact that, for example, all those financial institutions that we were talking about, mutual funds and insurance companies and banks and so forth, they don't know – nobody in Poland knows how to do any of that stuff. There was never any need for it in the past. I mean, just how to keep books, accounts payable, all that kind of thing. There was no need for it in the past, and so no wonder nobody knows how to do it. But that's a tremendous problem. And then beyond that, there's what people talk about as a kind of debauched work ethic, where people, where workers, in the old days, the old joke, as you know, is they pretend to pay us and we pretend to work. People would spend an awful lot of time playing hooky from their work to go stand in line, for example. And since you had to stand in line to get food, it was understandable. Now people probably still need to play hooky from work so as to get some other job so as to be able to buy the food that you don't have to stand in line for anymore. But at the end of the day, that's a problem. You have extremely low productivity, and it's not something you can just change overnight. You have to raise wages enough so people don't have to leave their jobs early to get other kind of jobs. There's all sorts of things like that. And again, we're talking about a situation where the American economy isn't doing so hot. I mean, in fact, all over the world where capitalism is working, you are having a increasing polarization of wealth, as you're seeing in the United States. You're seeing the middle class being eaten away with more and more people, with some people making it into the upper class and more people making it into falling back into the lower middle class and so forth. And So we don't have any particular solutions to offer polls in this regard.
Lawrence Wechsler is my guest, and he's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, and he's been writing about Poland for the past decade. His last trip there was in October, and he most recently wrote about Poland in the December 10th issue of The New Yorker. What effect is the Gulf crisis having in Poland now? Do they have shortages of oil?
It's not so much shortages of oil, but the price of oil has just skyrocketed. Mm-hmm. And this, by the way, is going to be the second big shock, because what's happening on January 1st of next year, I mean, in a few weeks now, is that all the Soviet prices with trade with the Soviet Union are going to go on a hard currency basis. So whereas before it didn't really matter what the world price of oil was, suddenly Poland is going to have to pay in dollars for or marks or some other hard currency for the oil they generally get from the Soviet Union at the world price. It's going to be disastrous. The other thing, by the way, about that's very problematic is that there's this noise when you're in Poland right now, when you're trying to talk to people, have conversation with people, you almost can't make yourself heard because of this racket. And people literally look to the east where this noise is coming from, and they say, you know, what the hell is going on over there? And that noise is the sound of the Soviet Union falling over the precipice. I mean, it is changing everything in Eastern Europe. The major trading partner of all these countries is falling into anarchy and taking down these countries with it. And, you know, these people, you literally, people cock their heads toward the east saying, I don't know what's going to happen. Look what's going on over there. And then in horror, they look at their own feet and they see the oil pipelines and the gas pipelines and so forth leading out from Warsaw toward the east. And they wonder whether they're going to be dragged down too. And in some places, they are being dragged down.
What leaves you the most optimistic and what leaves you the most concerned about Poland's future?
The most optimistic is for all of the vitriolic acting out that's been expressed in the last few years and the last few months, people like Michnik and Wałęsa and so forth. This is a remarkable group of people, Wałęsa included, by the way. And this is a generation that is the equivalent of the founding fathers of our own country. By the way, it's worth remembering that you know, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams fell out with each other and didn't have a word to say to each other for decades. That, you know, Alexander Hamilton was killed by Aaron Burr. I mean, there are all kinds of wild things that happened in the United States right after our victory. But this is a generation that is of that caliber. And there are great people there, and they have behaved extraordinarily more brilliantly than any other national liberation movement during the same period. So that's hopeful. What's difficult is what is the darkest, I think, is that the world that they are coming into, this kind of the capitalist world, exacts terribly difficult price, has rather serious disfiguring problems of its own. They are entering it hugely idealistically and with wide eyes and in huge innocence and are setting themselves up for some disastrous disappointments, I worry.
Lawrence Wechsler, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.